Last Sunday, we began a sermon series on the book of Habakkuk entitled Trusting God During Life's Trials. Habakkuk was a prophet in Judah, Israel's southern kingdom, in the period around 609 BC. The Babylonians had ascended to international dominance due to their superior military might and merciless subjection of the nations they conquered, including Judah, who would be greatly damaged in the process. Many of its citizens, including Daniel and his three friends, would be carried off into Babylonian captivity. The dialogue between Habakkuk and God that is recorded in the book that bears his name seems to have taken place in the midst of these Babylonian military campaigns, with Jerusalem being attacked in 597 BC. In last week's message, we considered Habakkuk's first complaint to God, a complaint that grew out of his being deeply shocked and deeply grieved by Judah's spiritual apostasy and social corruption, and by God's seeming inactivity in letting their wickedness go unchecked. So he raises his first complaint to God. Why do you look idly at wrong and leave Judah's sins unpunished? I'm sure many Ukrainians today, and even Russians suffering the consequences of their merciless leaders' unprovoked attack on Ukraine, are asking the same question of God. Why do you stand idly by and seemingly do nothing to stop the spread of evil? This is a classic question in theology. How can a loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God permit evil and suffering in the world? In the field of theology, this is known as theodicy. The argument goes like this. A God that allows suffering to continue is either A, not all-powerful and is thus unable to prevent the suffering, B, not loving because he has the power to prevent suffering but is unwilling to do so, and or C, is not all-knowing because he only is aware of the suffering after it has already occurred and it's too late to prevent it. So why is there evil in the world? There is an answer to that question, and it's in God's word. Evil exists only because God allows it to, for reasons of his own loving, all-powerful, all-knowing will. And it exists only for a time, likewise limited by God's sovereign will. Yes, in the beginning, God created all things. This included the angels, the most beautiful of which was Lucifer, or Satan, who due to his pride chose to rebel against God and was cast out of heaven. And though he is very powerful, Satan is a finite creature who is by no means a match for his almighty creator. As Martin Luther once said, the devil is God's devil and never operates outside the Lord's decree. This means the devil is on a leash, God's leash. Nor does the fact that evil exists mean that God is in any way culpable for evil. James 1:13 makes it clear that God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But Satan is the one who tempts and leads people to sin. Granted that God rules over Satan without himself being guilty of sin is a hard truth, but it is also comforting. It tells us that the evil we suffer is not purposeless, but will lead to our good and God's glory, as Romans 8:28 says, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are the called according to his purpose. This includes his good purposes for Judah. Though they were going to be subjected to great suffering at the hands of the demonic Babylonians, the Babylonians too were on a leash, God's leash. And he was going to use them as his instruments to bring his people into judgment for their sins. When he told Habakkuk this, it perplexed him even more than when God seemingly did nothing to punish the rampant evil being done by his people in Judah. So let's pick up where we left off last week as God answers Habakkuk's first complaint to him. In chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, God says to his prophet, "Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. They all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. By building earthen ramps, they capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty people whose own strength is their God." Habakkuk can't believe his ears. Like Vincini in the Princess Bride movie, he says to himself, "Inconceivable." This prompts Habakkuk to raise his second complaint to God, recorded in chapter 1, 12 through chapter 2, 1. "Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die." Now, there is a textual variant that says, "We will never die," and that reflects God's promise to Israel that though he may use their enemies to judge them, he will not let them be utterly consumed or destroyed. Habakkuk continues, "You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made people like the fish in the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet, for by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint." Habakkuk is bewildered by God's plan of action. How could a God who is too pure to look on evil appoint such a reprobate nation to savagely attack his covenant people and to execute judgment on a people more righteous than themselves? It's difficult for him to reconcile God's method with God's character. It just does not compute. And yet, as the eternal Lord who controls every power in history, God is free to choose the agents of his chastisement. including the aggressive, bloodthirsty Babylonians, whose own strength is their God. God responds to Habakkuk's second complaint by assuring him that justice will be served and the Babylonians will reap what they have sown. We read of this coming smackdown in chapter 2, verses 1 through 20. Then the Lord replied, "Write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by his faith. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest. Because he is as greedy as the grave and like death is never satisfied, he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, 'Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion?' How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. For you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you. Disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you, for you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman, or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, 'Come to life,' or to lifeless stone, 'Wake up.' Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him." Here God declares that the final outcome of history will be the worship of him, and that the destiny of nations and individuals alike will be determined by their attitude toward him as it finds expression in persevering and faithful dependence or haughty rejection. In turn, Habakkuk teaches us to let our doubts and questions drive us to God and to wait on the watchtower with patience and determination for his answer. The vision God has given him cannot be rushed, but a fixed period must elapse before the prophecy will be fulfilled. And this time of waiting can be endured with the Lord's guarantee of approaching fulfillment. If God has said he will bring something to pass, he will bring it to pass. God's judgment did indeed come on the Babylonians long after Habakkuk's vision. In fact, about 66 years after Habakkuk's prophecy. On October 29th, 539 BC, the hammer of God's wrath fell on the nation who had so arrogantly worshiped themselves and inflicted so much evil and suffering on Judah and the surrounding nations. Like Judah, Babylon found themselves on the receiving end of God's Board of Education, and it would prove cataclysmic, something that every nation and leader who is tyrannizing their people now should fear, with plenty of room for the same fear among leaders of our own country who seem to have lost any apparent fear of God. His divine retribution on Babylon for their sadistic and humiliating treatment of Judah would come by pouring out five woes on them in fulfillment of Proverbs 16:18, that pride goeth before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. This destruction and fall would come at the hands of King Cyrus and the Medes and Persians, another ruler and nation that God had sovereignly raised up to be instruments on earth. Well, this brings us to the end of chapter 2. Let's review what we've learned. First, Habakkuk, God reminds Habakkuk that evil will never ultimately prosper. Second, God is providentially orchestrating history for his own righteous purposes. Third, though the timing of God's just purposes may seem slow, it will surely come. It will not delay. Fourth, the five woes pronounced upon Babylon reveal God's judgment upon any human power that sets itself against his reign and rule. Think about it. Where's Nineveh today? That great capital city of the arrogant Assyrians. Vanished. Where is mighty Babylon today? Buried beneath the sands of the desert. What about the world powers of Ephesus, Rome, and Athens? All that remains of their ancient glory is a heap of ruins for tourists to gawk at. But what capital city does still stand? Jerusalem. And what people haven't vanished into thin air or been relegated to the annals of ancient history? Israel. God's chosen people thrive. Fifth, from the Tower of Babel to the empire builders of Rome, every generation will see kingdoms that achieve a measure of temporal, earthly success. God's righteousness, however, will triumph at the last, and his glory cover the whole earth, a promise ultimately fulfilled in Jesus Christ, before whom every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Sixth, although God's ways may seem inscrutable, his purposes are consistent, culminating in real and abundant life for the faithful, but in woe and death for the arrogant and unbelieving. Seventh, the Lord's presence in his temple affirms his lordship over history and assures us that one day his legitimate claim to the whole world will be universally acknowledged. Eighth, the righteous remnant of Christians living in nations rife with strife, oppression, immorality, idolatry, and wickedness can with supreme confidence live by faith. Faith in the loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God who remembers mercy in his wrath. Therefore, let all the earth be silent before him, and let us, like Habakkuk, continue trusting God during life's trials. Amen.